Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is March 11th. It's the day right after your second test. Let's see if I can turn that mic down just a little bit. And let's see, did I put the grades in Blackboard? I can't remember. Are they in Blackboard? You got them? Okay, good. Certainly, you're getting the test back in lab, and you can look over your tests. And if you got a question regarding your test, you should probably come see me, and we'll talk about the questions or whatever, but you're welcome to ask your lab instructor as well. But sometimes they can't read my mind either when I write a question, so you're welcome to come talk to me, okay? And let's see, looking at the schedule, our exam number 3 is going to be on April 15th, which is not till after spring break. So you can do a lot of really good work over spring break, which is coming up in just a couple weeks. And then the drop date is May 1st, according to my schedule right here. That seems a little late, but I think I tried to put it correctly in there. All right, I don't know what the scores are like. Typically, in this class, students really don't start studying until somewhere between the third and fourth test. I don't know why that is. Okay, so there were a fair number of A's, but on that fourth and fifth test, almost everybody in here is going to get an A. So I guess use that little motivation to start really applying yourself and start getting some A's on these tests coming up, the next one. Yeah. The next test, chapter 9. Chapter 10, which is sensory, and probably 11, so 9, 10, and 11. I don't know if we're going to get to 12, which is muscle physiology, but I might have a little bit better idea as we get through. All right, So that's a really good question, because today we got to cover a chapter, and that's going to be chapter 9, autonomic nervous system. And I probably can't get through that today, and certainly we're not going to get through it unless I shut up and start talking about it. Okay? So anyway, congratulations getting done with that second test. You'll get them back in lab. Okay? Okay. You did study the autonomic nervous system pretty extensively in anatomy, so you're going to find some of the lectures similar, and we're going to add to some of that information today. All right, let me get the slideshow started right here. All right, so autonomic nervous system, maybe I just might start out by asking a couple questions. Autonomic nervous system, what the heck good is it? What does it do for us? What does it control in our bodies? Okay, heart. Yeah, so cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. And what's the only other part of your body? Skeletal muscle. That's right, so you got four main parts. You got skeletal muscle, and then you got cardiac muscle, smooth muscle, and glands. All right? And the autonomic nervous system controls three of those four major parts of your body, right? And that means the only thing that you really can control in your body is what kind of effector? Is skeletal muscle. Everything else is controlled by the autonomic nervous system, so this is a hugely important nervous system. And from anatomy, you know that there are two main divisions of the autonomic nervous system. What are they called? Anybody remember the names? Sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, right? And their main mode of action, how would you describe the relationship between those two divisions of the ANS? How would you describe that relationship? Okay. Some people would say fight or flight versus rest and digest or rest and repose, right? Those are what? Antagonistic mechanisms, right? Antagonistic effects. So that's really what I want you to think about in terms of parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system, is that they are antagonistic to each other. And is that a good thing or bad thing? Yeah, that's typically a very good thing, so you have precise control and balance over these vital parts of your body, because you can't control them even if you wanted to, right? Because they're hooked up to the autonomic nervous system. All right, so the autonomic nervous system manages our physiology. As a matter of fact, we see most of our physiology by regulating organs and organ systems, all right, through the effects on smooth muscle, glands, and you should probably pencil in, what's the third part? Cardiac muscle as well. Okay. Smooth muscle maintains a resting tone in the absence of nerve stimulation. Unlike skeletal muscle will be flaccid. It won't contract unless it is stimulated. Smooth muscle and even cardiac muscle, all right, have some inherent activity associated with them. All right, many types of smooth muscle, like cardiac muscle, is spontaneously active and contract rhythmically without autonomic nervous system innervation. So you probably remember from Raiders of the Lost Ark, right? If you move somebody's heart from their chest and put it on the table or any kind of mammal, it's going to beat, right? And indeed, that is true. What the autonomic nervous system does is that it regulates, it controls how fast it beats and the force of contraction as well. And you're going to see that there are some similarities with smooth muscle as well. All right, so the autonomic nervous system just simply increases or decreases that intrinsic activity of cardiac muscle and smooth muscle. When smooth muscle becomes denervated, when it loses innervation, it actually becomes more sensitive. All right, we call that denervation hypersensitivity after a short period of shock where the muscle doesn't contract at all. All right, so these different kinds of muscles, cardiac and smooth muscle, are a lot different than skeletal muscle, which is what you're mostly familiar with. All right, so let's get into some of the neuroanatomy of the autonomic nervous system. Well, we see spinal cord right here. All right, what's spinal cord? How would you understand the spinal cord? What part of the nervous system is that? Yeah, by structure, it's part of the central nervous system. Okay, and we have two different illustrations. We got A and B. The one on the top right here is what we call a somatic motor reflex because it involves skeletal muscle, right, which is not in a body cavity someplace that's more located more superficially on your body. Typically, we call that a somatic system. And notice how many neurons it takes to get from the central nervous system to this effector organ right here for the somatic pathway. How many nerves do you see going from central nervous system to this effector organ? And what kind of nerve is that going to be? Tell me something about that nerve in terms of its function. Okay, well, if I use that term effector organ, you know what I'm talking about. It's something that produces an effect, right, when it's stimulated, and that skeletal muscle, when it's stimulated, is going to do what? It's just going to contract, and it's going to produce some kind of motion in your body, for instance, right? And we see one neuron going from the gray matter of the spinal cord, all right, and you should know all these parts. What part is this right here? This is the, okay, this is the ventral root, right? So here we have a motor neuron, and that's an efferent neuron because it's going to that effector, right? So motor neuron and effector neuron are basically the same. It goes through the ventral root out the spinal nerve to this effector organ right here. So there's just one single neuron taking information all the way to this skeletal muscle. Can you remember what the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction in every single case? It is acetylcholine. And the receptor types are nicotinic type receptors. So when acetylcholine binds to that receptor, that opens up a sodium channel, which produces... When a sodium channel opens up, what happens to a cell? It depolarizes, right? That's an excitatory event, and then that's eventually going to cause contraction of those muscle fibers in there. Okay? So this right here is a whole somatic motor reflex where you have receptors stimulating the sensory nerve. What's another name for a sensory neuron? Afferent, that's right. And you should probably know the type of neuron by its shape, by its structure as well. This afferent neuron is what kind of neuron? All right, maybe I'll tell you really quickly. It's a unipolar neuron, and here is the cell body, and there's going to be a group of these cell bodies in the dorsal root ganglia, and that's what a ganglion is, right? It's a group of nerve cell bodies someplace in what part of the nervous system? A ganglion is in the peripheral nervous system, right? And then, so this is the peripheral process, here's the central process entering the central nervous system where it synapses on an association neuron, otherwise you might call this an interneuron, and that completes that whole loop that you had to memorize for the first test, right? A response loop always starts with a stimulus and it ends in a response produced by this effector organ right here. So that's a nice simple reflex loop. All right, if we contrast that with the autonomic nervous system, okay, let's look at how many neurons it takes to leave the central nervous system to get to an effector organ. So we're going to look at the motor pathway, right, the output. So what do we see right here? Here is the cell body. That's going to be in the lateral horn, and that's going to leave the ventral root. All right, but does that go all the way to an effector organ? Notice where it stops right here in a ganglion someplace. Right, and in this particular case, this is one of two possible ganglia. This is a sympathetic chain ganglia where it synapses on the postganglionic neuron, which then takes that information the rest of the way to the effector organ. So this right here is a chemical synapse similar to the neuromuscular junction, and in all cases for the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, the neurotransmitter that's used is acetylcholine, and the receptors on the preganglionic fiber is always going to be a nicotinic receptor, right? So that when acetylcholine binds to that receptor, it's going to be an excitatory event on this postganglionic fiber. All right, so make sure that you can see that for a somatic pathway, how many neurons go to the effector organ? How many do you need? Just one, right? But for an autonomic motor reflex, we need two, and so there's going to be a ganglion someplace in between with one exception that we're going to talk about. Okay, it's just a modification of this scheme right here. And in every case, the postganglionic fiber right here is going to be stimulated by what neurotransmitter? Acetylcholine. And it's going to be stimulated through a nicotinic type receptor. What's another kind of receptor for acetylcholine? Yeah, muscarinic. So at least now you know a couple different kinds, right? So we're going to build on that knowledge a little bit. All right, so sometimes this effector organ we call a target tissue. Okay, so the divisions, remember we got sympathetic and parasympathetic. They usually have antagonistic effects. We're going to learn just a few exceptions to that rule. So they coordinate all the physiology inside your body. Sympathetic mediates what we call the fight, flight, stress reactions in your body. And this probably is really important to get a pretty good understanding of the difference between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, is to actually think of these two in these ways. Fight, flight, and stress versus rest and repose and rest and digest. Because it will save you a lot of memorizing what the effects of a particular autonomic nervous system effect is on in your physiology. Okay, so for instance, let's think about the difference between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system, and who's got to go and work tonight? Who's got a work shift tonight? A couple people got to go work tonight. Okay, well let's just say maybe you're working at Blockbuster, okay, and you're renting videos to people, right? And what is today? Thursday? Maybe you're not going to have a lot of customers. Right, so you go to work and you take your physiology book with you because you never know, and it just so happens that nobody shows up at work. And so what do you do with your time? You pop all the popcorn that's in the store? Probably not. You open up your book and you start to study and you read a couple chapters, right? And so you're accomplishing a lot of things. You're earning some cash because you're working, right? And you're getting some of your homework done. You're getting some studying done. So how are you feeling about yourself? Really good, all right? What is your heart rate like? Is it accelerated? Or are you in a relaxed state? You're kind of in a relaxed state. You're accomplishing a lot. There's not a lot of stress placed on you, all right? And then it comes to the end of your shift, and you hardly had any customers, and you got to cash out the register, and all the receipts match all the cash that's in the drawer, so that's really nice. You don't have to put in $20 or $30 to make up any money that got lost in the transactions. And you answered all the questions, the quantitative questions at the end of a couple chapters in the physiology book. So how are you feeling now? You've really accomplished a lot. Plus you earned some salary, so that's really, really nice. So what nervous system is operating in you right now? Parasympathetic nervous system, right? So everything is under control, nice and relaxed, and you're feeling really good. All right, so it's time to go home, and everything in the store is really, really good. You find your keys, ready to go out the door, and just as you're about ready to go out to your car, all of a sudden the power goes out in the neighborhood, right? Store goes black, parking lights, parking lot lights go dark, okay? And you go, now what are you thinking? What's happening to you? Okay, well, you might be a little bit nervous, right? There's a little perturbation to your perfect universe, right? And so you step outside and you put the key in the lock and you lock the door and you take a couple steps to your car and then you realize, oh, when you got to work, the parking lot was full. And you had to park out in the neighborhood, two blocks away. That was the closest you could park. And all the lights in the neighborhood are out. All right, so now what's happening to you? Are you in a rest and digest, rest and repose kind of mood or what? No, you're a little bit aroused. You're a little bit anxious, right? Because you got to walk through a place you're not familiar with all the lights out. So what is your heart rate doing? It's accelerating. What about pupil dilation? Are your pupils constricting so that you can't see very well, or are they kind of dilating? Yeah, you're dilating. What about perspiration? Starting to sweat a little bit, okay? And what about your respiratory rate? It is increasing, right? You're starting to hyperventilate a little bit. All right, now, what about your digestive system? Is your digestive system being activated? Is that going to be the most important system that's working for you right now, or is it going to be more like your lungs and heart and your vision? Okay, so the digestive system is kind of shutting down because the digestive system is not important for the flight or fight response that's being produced by the sympathetic nervous system due to these, right, uncomfortable circumstances that you're just experiencing. All right, so your lung function is increasing, your cardiovascular function is increasing, your digestive function, on the other hand, is decreasing because you don't need that particular system at this point in time. Okay, so you start walking to your car. You go, okay, well, let's get to my car. And you get about halfway there, and then you hear some footsteps behind you. Now what happens to your pupil dilation and your heart rate, perspiration, respirations? What's happening? They're even more, they're even becoming more activated. All right, so that's the sympathetic nervous system that's taking over, right? And the parasympathetic nervous system is kind of getting lost in the background, right, to just maintain yourself until you get to your car. And then, just as you get to your car, you hear me say, oh, what are you doing out so late at night? Okay, and so then what nervous system is taking over? Right, then you're going back from sympathetic nervous system to the parasympathetic nervous system because you hear a familiar voice and everything is okay. And you get home, and then what do you do when you get home? Well, then you even study some more, right? And that even gets that parasympathetic nervous system going even a little bit better because you know you're going to ace the next exam. All right, so in terms of memorizing what the two divisions of the autonomic nervous system do to various organs in your body, just think of these two general categories, fight, flight, and stress versus rest and repose or rest and digest. That will help you when you take a look at a chapter that we got to look at. All right, so let's analyze the sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system. Sometimes we call this the thoracolumbar division because of the efferent outflow from the central nervous system. Right, sympathetic information can only leave through the thorax and lumbar divisions of the spinal cord. They can't leave through cranial nerves or from the sacral or even from cervical regions of the spinal cord. So from T1 to L2, this is where sympathetics leave. Right, so here's a spinal cord, and they can leave. And how does information leave the central nervous system? One of two routes, right? Which root does it leave? Yeah, the ventral root. We saw that already. All right, so sympathetic nerves leave the ventral root, okay? But they don't continue on through the spinal nerve. They actually have to leave the spinal nerve and go into the sympathetic chain ganglia, right? And the sympathetic chain ganglia are like small auxiliary spinal cords on either side of these vertebral bodies right here. And sympathetic nerves can either arise a few divisions or descend a few divisions through the sympathetic chain ganglia or actually pass through, right? But sometimes they synapse, right, onto the postganglionic cell. So there is a group of postganglionic cell bodies right here that produces a little node or nodule that we call, what do we call a little node or nodule filled with cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system? That's a ganglion, right? So these are the sympathetic chain ganglia. And then the postganglionic fiber can re-enter the spinal nerve and go to its effector organ. So these ganglia of the sympathetic chain are called paravertebral ganglia because they're on either side. Right? Para just means by the side of the spinal cord. Okay. The sympathetic division is characterized by divergence and convergence of signals. All right, so we saw a bunch of different pathways for nerves entering and leaving and mixing within the sympathetic chain. All right, so when you have a bunch of nerve fibers that can diverge and then reconverge again, all right, that spreads the sympathetic information throughout the whole body very efficiently. So we call that mass activation. So that's another way to think of the sympathetic nervous system. It's very difficult to stimulate one effector organ with the sympathetic nervous system without stimulating the whole body because of where all these signals are going to. All right, so for instance, here we have the spinal cord again. And we have the preganglionic fibers leaving the ventral root, entering the sympathetic chain. And here we can see that this nerve splits up into a number of different axons. Right? So it synapses in the sympathetic chain ganglia, stimulates the postganglionic fiber. But the preganglionic fiber can also bifurcate and go up a couple divisions through the sympathetic chain or go down a couple divisions. Or it can even pass through the sympathetic chain without synapsing and go to another ganglion someplace. All right, so when this one motor neuron in the sympathetic nervous system gets stimulated, where does that signal go? It goes everywhere in the body, right, because of these divergent pathways. So we call that mass activation. All right, so there are many different routes that sympathetic information can get to all different parts of the body. So that is the divergent signal. The convergent signal also shows, let's see if I can find an example of convergence. All right, so here we see divergence, and here is that same neuron leaving at a different level from the sympathetic chain, right, and then anastomosing coming back together in this collateral ganglion right here, so that is convergence. All right, so this information is shared through a very broad, complex network of sympathetic fibers that guarantees that all sympathetic receptors are going to be stimulated. Right, we call that mass activation. Some postganglionics do not synapse in the paravertebral ganglia. What the paravertebral are going to be what these, the sympathetic chain right here. But some synapse in what we call the collateral or prevertebral ganglia. Prevertebral just means in front of the vertebral column. And does anybody know the name of a nerve that's taking sympathetic information from the sympathetic chain to the collateral ganglion? We should at least have, there are a number of them, but they all have one common word.
Phrenic.
Okay. Phrenic is really close. It sounds like it, except it starts with a S instead of a P. Okay, a splanchnic nerve. Yeah, splanchnic. All right, so there are a number of splanchnic nerves, which are nerves that carry preganglionic information to a collateral ganglion someplace, or to the adrenal medulla, which is going to spread sympathetic information throughout the body. Okay, so the adrenal medulla is an important neuroendocrine gland that is especially important in mass activation. All right, so the adrenal medulla is located in the adrenal gland, and remember, a gland or various organs in your body can have two different kinds of parts to it, depending on where they're located. Some parts of an organ are superficial, other parts are deep. Like bone. Bone is compact on the surface, but on the interior of the bone, What kind of bone do you have by structure? It looks spongy, right? So another way of talking about compact bone is that it's cortical bone. It's on the surface, all right? But spongy bone, we don't call that cortical bone. We call that medullary bone, right? So the cortex of an organ is the superficial part. The medullary part is the deep part. And the adrenal gland can be characterized that same way. All right, and in this chapter, what we're really interested in is the adrenal medulla. So is that the deep part or the superficial part of the adrenal gland? That's the deep part. Okay. And the adrenal gland is located superior to the kidney. And the adrenal medulla is really a modified collateral ganglion. All right. When it receives stimulation from the preganglionic fiber, there are cells that are called chromaffin cells that release epinephrine and norepinephrine. Now, the adrenal medulla is really an endocrine gland. So when an endocrine gland releases its product that it's synthesizing, right, where does that product end up if it's an endocrine gland? It goes, some people might have said, but I didn't quite hear it. Okay, so an endocrine gland, remember, is a gland that secretes a product into the circulatory system, not a duct, right? An exocrine gland secretes its product into a duct someplace, right? So the adrenal medulla is an endocrine gland, so it's going to synthesize and secrete epinephrine and norepinephrine, and that epinephrine and norepinephrine gets absorbed by a capillary, ends up in the blood, and once it's in the blood, where does all that epinephrine and norepinephrine go? Everywhere that blood is going in the body. All right, so that ensures that that sympathetic activity, that sympathetic signal goes where? Everywhere in the body, not only through the nervous system that is characterized by divergence and convergence, but because of the cardiovascular system takes that sympathetic signal everywhere. Right, and for sure the adrenal gland is stimulated by mass activation, and indeed it enhances mass activation. The adrenal medulla also releases some other kinds of compounds like endorphins, right, which you could consider modulators of nociceptors. What's a nociceptor? It's a pain receptor, okay, and so endorphins can reduce the sensitivity of those pain receptors in your body. Sometimes we think of those as natural opiates. Okay, so what does epinephrine and norepinephrine look like? Well, the precursor molecule is tyrosine. That is an amino acid. But what kind of an amino acid is that? That's probably something you should know. It is what we call an essential amino acid. Your body cannot make tyrosine. You have to have that in your diet. And from tyrosine, right, the adrenal medulla can make norepinephrine and epinephrine. So these are related compounds. Epinephrine, sometimes we actually call that adrenaline. You've heard of adrenaline before. Norepinephrine, sometimes people call noradrenaline. That's not quite so common. But you can see that the adrenal medulla makes epinephrine from norepinephrine by what kind of process? Just a really simple methylation of this amino group right here that changes the behavior of that molecule completely just by the addition of this little methyl group. All right, so know that the precursor molecule is tyrosine, and then that is converted into norepinephrine, and then finally epinephrine, which is secreted by the chromaffin cells. Let me go back to maybe this picture right here. All right. So here I don't see the adrenal gland, but we could pretend it's the adrenal gland. If it was, it would be sitting on top of a kidney. All right, so the solid line represents what? What does the solid line represent? That's the preganglionic fiber, and it's going to pass right through the sympathetic chain through a splanchnic nerve going to the adrenal medulla, where it's going to synapse on the postganglionic cell. But in the adrenal medulla, instead of a postganglionic cell going to an effector organ someplace, these cells don't have axons. When they depolarize, they release norepinephrine and epinephrine directly into the blood. Okay, and then it's carried everywhere in the body. So that's why sometimes we say that the adrenal gland is really a modified collateral ganglion organ. Okay. All right, so let's talk about the parasympathetic nervous system. The anatomy is quite different. It has cranial sacral outflow. All right, so we call that the cranial sacral division because it can only send parasympathetic information out through a number of cranial nerves and then also through nerves that leave S1 through S4. Ooh, what does that S stand for? Sacral, yeah, the sacral region. Okay, and these nerves, these are the preganglionic nerves, go all the way to the effector organ. They don't go to a sympathetic chain or to a prevertebral ganglion someplace. They go all the way to the effector organ. But since they're autonomic nervous systems, there still is a postganglionic fiber in the effector organ, right? And so that ganglion in the effector organ is just what we call a terminal ganglia, and they're very, very small. Right? And these terminal ganglia are located very close to or within the target organ themselves. So the postganglionic fibers are very, very short. They go just a very short distance because the terminal ganglia is located in the target organ. All right, so nonetheless, parasympathetic information does get all over the body, primarily through the vagus nerve. All right, and what can you tell me about the vagus nerve? Where does that come out of? Does that come out of your cervical region or thoracic region, lumbar region? Where is that vagus nerve at? You probably have a picture of it with how many other nerves? 12 other nerves, right, from the base of the brain, right? So, and vagus nerve is just cranial nerve number 10, and it passes down through the neck, and then it bifurcates and goes to many organs in the body. And so it just kind of wanders around all over the place. All right, so it innervates the heart, lungs, esophagus, stomach, pancreas, the upper half of the large intestine. All right, but the lower parts of the digestive tract and urinary bladder are innervated by outflow through the sacral nerves, S2 through S4. Okay, so urinary reproductive systems from S2 through S4. So here is a nice overview of the whole autonomic nervous system. And we've got red versus blue. And I'm not sure that I got this picture from your book. I can't remember where I got it from. Is that in your book? Oh, I'm glad it is. Okay. All right, so blue is what kind of division? Blue is the parasympathetic or what? Craniosacral division. And this red right here is the thoracolumbar or sympathetic division of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so here we see, if we're parasympathetic nerves, how many nerves does it take to get from the CNS to an effector organ? How many does it take? Two, as opposed to somatic pathway only requires one motor neuron. Okay, so let's follow maybe cranial nerve number 10. So here is the outflow through the vagus nerve, and it goes all the way to the lung before it synapses, and this dotted line represents the postganglionic fiber. So the preganglionic fiber is very, very long. The postganglionic fiber is really short for the parasympathetic nervous system. As opposed to the sympathetic nervous system. All right, so let's follow this motor neuron from T1 out to the sympathetic chain, and here it synapses because we see this dotted line. What does this dotted line here represent? The postganglionic fiber. So the preganglionic fiber for most sympathetic nerves are very short, but the postganglionic fiber is very, very long. All right, so that's a nice distinction between the parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous system. And what's happening in this ganglion right here? How is information being passed from the preganglionic to the postganglionic cell? Yeah, it's a chemical synapse. Right, and the neurotransmitter is acetylcholine. Right, so you see all of these ganglia. Right, here and in the sympathetic chain and the prevertebral ganglia. Right, the neurotransmitter in every single case is going to be acetylcholine, and the receptor type on the postganglionic cell is always going to be a nicotinic type receptor. Right, it's always going to produce an excitatory event. All right, so can you appreciate this diagram right here? Preganglionic fibers versus post. But look at this one right here. Here's a preganglionic sympathetic fiber that goes into the sympathetic chain, but what does it do? Does it synapse? Can you see that it just passes right through without synapsing on a postganglionic cell? It passes right through to get to this celiac ganglia. This is a prevertebral ganglia where it synapses on the postganglionic cell. All right, so don't forget, going if there is a preganglionic fiber that just passes through the sympathetic chain to a prevertebral ganglia, that's what we call a splanchnic nerve. All right, so these are all different kinds of splanchnic nerves that just pass straight through. All right, but what is the neurotransmitter that's being used in the celiac ganglion right here? It's acetylcholine, right, through some kind of nicotinic receptor. And the one last case that I want to show you that's really special is that here is the kidney, and here is the adrenal gland, and in particular, I want you to think of the adrenal medulla, which is which part of the adrenal gland, the deep part or superficial part? That's the deep part. Okay, so what kind of fiber is going to the adrenal medulla? Is it sympathetic or parasympathetic? Which one is that? I hear not too many people saying out loud. Say really loud. It's sympathetic. How do you know that's sympathetic? You could say, well, because it's red, but that won't help on the test. Okay. How do you know that's a sympathetic fiber going to the adrenal medulla? Because where is it coming from? Thoracolumbar outflow. So it's got to be sympathetic. And you know that that is a preganglion. How do you know this is a preganglionic fiber? Because it's sort of long, okay, but more importantly, it's just a solid line. It's not a dashed line because the dashed lines represent the postganglionic fibers, right? So in this particular circuit right here, do you see a postganglionic fiber? There is no postganglionic fiber because the cells of the adrenal medulla are really acting as the postganglionic fiber. All right. So these chromaffin cells release epinephrine and norepinephrine directly into the blood. They don't transmit electrical impulses to an effector organ. So sometimes we call the adrenal medulla a neuroendocrine gland because it has some characteristics of being an endocrine gland, but it also has some characteristics of being a neuron. Why does it have a characteristic of being a neuron? Because what is it releasing? It's releasing norepinephrine, which is typically, we learn that as being a neurotransmitter, right? But it's also considered an endocrine gland because what happens to that norepinephrine? It gets picked up by the circulatory system and carried through the body like a hormone, right? So sometimes we consider the adrenal medulla a neuroendocrine gland because it has some characteristics of being a nerve and other characteristics of being an endocrine gland. All right, so here are some of the effects that we see with the autonomic nervous system. All right, so here are a bunch of effector organs in the first column. Second column is the sympathetic effect, and then the third column is the parasympathetic effect. All right, and we said that in most cases, what's the relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system? Antagonistic to each other. And let's look down this list and we'll see if that is true in a couple circumstances. Well, let's look at the ciliary muscle. Okay, ciliary muscle is important for accommodation. It's what allows you to look at things up close or far away, but not both at the same time. All right, the sympathetic nervous system relaxes the ciliary muscle for far vision, but the parasympathetic causes contraction of that very same muscle. Right, and that's important for near vision. And we're going to talk about that in the next chapter, I believe, which is senses. What is another good one for antagonistic action? Well, let's look at the heart. In terms of heart rate, right, the sympathetic nervous system increases heart rate, but the parasympathetic decreases heart rate. So the mixing of the sympathetic and parasympathetic, the autonomic nervous system has precise control over your heart rate. And what else? Blood vessels, right? The sympathetic constricts most blood vessels, right? But the parasympathetic can actually dilate a few blood vessels. For instance, a good example of that would be in the penis when the word is escaping me. Okay, erection, during erection. Okay. Another important organ, okay, is the dilation of bronchioles. What is a bronchiole? What's a bronchiole? It says tube. What kind of tube? A bronchiole is a tube for air, that's carrying air, right? Okay, and so the sympathetic is going to cause dilation, the parasympathetic is going to cause constriction. Obviously, these are antagonistic effects. All right, now, what was the main way that we wanted to characterize the parasympathetic nervous system? Is it the fight or flight or rest and digest? All right, so let's look at gastrointestinal tract. In terms of mobility or motility, the sympathetic nervous system inhibits peristalsis, but the parasympathetic stimulates peristalsis. All right, so let's compare this with heart rate. All right, sympathetic increases the heart rate, but what does sympathetic do on the gastrointestinal tract? Inhibits. So you can't say that the sympathetic nervous system always is excitatory. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. The only thing that you can usually say with accuracy is what's the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic? They're opposite to each other, right? So the sympathetic is not always excitatory. The parasympathetic is not always inhibitory. You just know that sympathetic and parasympathetic usually are antagonistic to each other. And just use those two ways of thinking about the autonomic nervous system to know which way things will go. So for instance, when you're in the fight or flight mode, what about blood glucose levels? Let's see if I have some blood glucose levels right here. All right. What do you think should happen to glucose, blood glucose levels? What good is blood glucose? What can you do with blood glucose? Yeah, you can make ATP out of it. Is that a handy molecule to have when you're trying to fly away someplace? Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so where can you get glucose from? Say you're in a fasted state. There's an organ that has a huge store of glucose, namely the liver, right? And if you want to boost blood glucose because you're in a fight or flight mode, the sympathetic nervous system can go to the liver and it causes hydrolysis of glycogen. Oh, what do we call that process? They should actually wipe this out and put what? Stimulates glycogenolysis. And that increases your blood glucose. Okay. So that's important to know about. The relationship between sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system can also be characterized in a couple organ systems in a minor way, all right, as either being cooperative or complementary. All right, so complementary is when they produce similar kinds of effects. A good example of complementary action is sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation of salivary glands. They both produce saliva, okay, but the saliva becomes very thick because it decreases blood flow to the salivary glands. But parasympathetic nervous system, all right, produces a very watery kind of saliva. So we call that the complementary nature of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems. And then the last way that we talk about the relationship sometimes is through cooperation. Sometimes the parasympathetic and sympathetic, right, will work in ways to produce the same kind of effect. For instance, the sympathetic nervous system is responsible for ejaculation. Okay, and ejaculation has good survival value if what? If there is erection, right? So the parasympathetic nervous system produces erection, sympathetic produces ejaculation. So that's what we call the cooperative effects of the sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous system. Yeah. Yeah, here it is right here. Thanks for reminding me. I should set my timer. Okay, so sign it really fast. Okay. autonomic nervous system neurotransmitters. Let's just kind of layer on some knowledge of neurotransmitters with neuroanatomy. And so here we see central nervous system again. And we see craniosacral outflow. Right? Craniosacral outflow is what kind of autonomic nervous system? That's the parasympathetic, right? And thoracolumbar is sympathetic. Okay, and again, here we see a solid colored neuron. That's the preganglionic, and the dotted line is the postganglionic fiber. And for every particular case, right, it takes the preganglionic and postganglionic nerve fiber to get to an effector organ, with one exception. What's the one exception to that rule? Okay, the one exception is where you have just a preganglionic fiber going all the way to the adrenal medulla. And the adrenal medulla really is acting like the postganglionic fiber. Okay. So there is a similarity between all of these preganglionic fibers. They all release the same neurotransmitter, which is acetylcholine. When a nerve fiber releases acetylcholine, we call it a cholinergic fiber, and that synapse is a cholinergic synapse. All right, so it's got to have an acetylcholine receptor on the postganglionic cell or the postsynaptic cell. All right. Now, for the parasympathetic nervous system, the postganglionic fiber also releases acetylcholine. So how would you characterize the postganglionic fiber for the parasympathetic nervous system? It is cholinergic as well, because it is releasing acetylcholine. Now, these effectors of the parasympathetic nervous system don't always have to be nicotinic. They can either be nicotinic or muscarinic. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Okay, so let's get back now, let's change topics from the parasympathetic to the sympathetic nervous system. So here we see thoracolumbar outflow, and maybe through the sympathetic chain, or through a collateral ganglia, or to the adrenal medulla. All of these preganglionic fibers are nicotinic, but the postganglionic fibers release release norepinephrine. The adrenal medulla also releases a little epinephrine. So these fibers right here are not cholinergic. We call these adrenergic because they're releasing norepinephrine. All right, so there's a big difference between adrenergic versus cholinergic nerve fibers. So if I were to point at this one right here, is this an adrenergic fiber or a cholinergic fiber? And let me define what this is. This is what? The postganglionic sympathetic fiber. So let me ask the question really intelligently. What kind of fiber is this sympathetic postganglionic fiber? Is it cholinergic or adrenergic?
Adrenergic.
It's adrenergic because it releases norepinephrine. Right. All right, so the other nice thing that this slide shows, which is a really handy exam figure, is what happens to this epinephrine and norepinephrine from the adrenal medulla. Where does it go? It goes into this capillary right here, which then takes it to effectors, visceral effectors everywhere in the body to produce mass activation of the sympathetic nervous system. Okay. So there's a little bit of difference. You did learn of what the neuromuscular junction looks like in anatomy, as well as a typical kind of synapse. Right, a typical kind of synapse has a bouton terminale at the end of an axon, or a terminal button, or what, an axon terminal. It goes by a whole bunch of different names, that contains neurotransmitter in a synaptic vesicle. But for the autonomic nervous system, notice that along an axon, we have these swellings right here that also contain synaptic vesicles filled with neurotransmitter, right? It's just not at the end of the axon, but it's along the whole length of the axon right here. So these we call varicosities. So sympathetic nerves and parasympathetic nerves have these varicosities within the effector organ. And so sometimes we call these synapses en passant because they're located along the axon. As that action potential moves along the axon, that stimulates release of neurotransmitter on these effector organs. All right, so here we have a smooth muscle cell, and on one side, you see the sympathetic neuron, and it might cause stimulation or contraction of the smooth muscle. And then on the other side, we have the parasympathetic neuron, which is going to inhibit the smooth muscle. And it's the mixing of these antagonistic effects that controls the smooth muscle precisely. So here you have the adrenergic receptors responding to norepinephrine, and you have the cholinergic receptors responding to acetylcholine. Okay. All right, so let's just think about these adrenergic receptors for a second, just the adrenergic. So adrenergic stimulation can cause excitation, or maybe it can cause inhibition, depending on the tissue. Right, and so you're going to have to come to grips, you'll have to be able to describe how is it that one neurotransmitter, right, what's going to be the neurotransmitter for adrenergic stimulation? It's going to be norepinephrine. How is it that norepinephrine can cause different effects in different tissues? How can one neurotransmitter cause different effects? Okay, that's a pretty good thought because it acts as a neurotransmitter, but from the adrenal medulla, it also acts as a hormone. Okay, but I don't want to go down that road. Okay, there's a better way of thinking about that. Okay, and that's because even though there is one neurotransmitter, norepinephrine, there are different kinds of receptors within different target tissues. And there are two main kinds of receptors. They're the alpha and the beta. And guess which ones they found first? Alpha, right? And then they found some more. So we call those betas. All right, so there are different kinds of receptors in different target tissues, and we even know that there are even subtypes of these major types of receptors. So there's alpha 1, alpha 2, right? And that's, we're going to learn about some of these in this class, and there's even subtypes that we're not going to pay close attention to in this class. All right? And then we got beta 1 and beta 2. And I'll tell you exactly what you have to know about these different subtypes. But first, let's talk about some of the similarities between these different kinds of receptors right here. Now, what kind of receptors are these? Are these cholinergic or adrenergic? Adrenergic. Why do you say adrenergic? Because they're going to bind norepinephrine. The ligand is norepinephrine. Okay? And they're going to bind to a receptor which is on the extracellular side of the plasma membrane, and that receptor is coupled to a G protein. Right? So they're G protein coupled receptors. All alphas and all betas are G protein coupled receptors, and G protein coupled receptors work through second messenger systems. And we looked at a couple of them. Cyclic AMP is one second messenger, and calcium is another second messenger. All beta receptors use cyclic AMP, and all alpha receptors use calcium as a second messenger inside the cell. All right, can you remember, how does cyclic AMP get made in the cell? Yeah, because the G protein, well, first you have norepinephrine binding to the receptor, which activates the G protein. The G protein dissociates, right, and one of the subunits bumps into adenylate cyclase on the cell membrane, and then that converts ATP into cyclic AMP. And remember that adenylate cyclase is an enzyme. It doesn't get used up in that reaction, so adenylate cyclase produces, what, thousands and thousands of cyclic AMP molecules inside the cell, which is going to change the metabolism inside the cell. All right, so remember that alpha receptors work through calcium as a second messenger, beta work through cyclic AMP. All right, so let's look at some of the physiology, some of the physiologic effects of different receptors on different organs. So here we have table 9.5. We got the eye and the heart, right? Blood vessels in the skin, lungs, and for instance, the liver. All right, and we're not going to pay much attention to alpha 2 receptors. Alpha 2 receptors are in the central nervous system, and they can affect many different autonomic systems throughout the body, the effects in the brain. But what I want to focus on are the effector organs in body compartments and not the central nervous system. All right, so let's start with alpha-1. Alpha-1 causes contraction of radial fibers within the iris, which pulls the pupil open, right, which causes the dilation of the pupils. Right, alpha-1s also cause constriction of smooth muscle in arterioles. Right, and when smooth muscle in an arteriole contracts, the diameter of an arteriole decreases. And when a diameter decreases, that impedes the flow of blood to that particular organ. It gets cut off. All right, so alpha-1 causes vasoconstriction of blood vessels, okay, and also, right, causes constriction of sphincters, which is a smooth muscle in various parts of the digestive tract, right? So alpha-1 receptors typically are excitatory receptors, which cause smooth muscle to contract. And if it's smooth muscle in an arteriole, it shuts down the blood supply. If it's a smooth muscle in the intestine, it stops motility of food from one part of the intestine to the other. Now, does that sort of make sense to you? That sympathetic stimulation on the digestive tract is typically what? Excitatory or inhibitory? Okay, it's inhibitory. It decreases digestion because it causes sphincters to contract. But what part of the autonomic nervous system should stimulate the digestive system? It's the parasympathetic, right? So sympathetic decreases motility and digestive function because you don't need to be doing that when you're in a stressful circumstance. Okay, so that's the alpha-1 receptor, primarily excitatory on smooth muscle. Beta-1 receptors we have in the heart, and beta-1 receptors are excitatory as well, just like the alpha-1. And how many hearts do you have? This is you have one. All right, so this is going to be an easy way for you to remember this. You have one heart, all right? You don't really have alpha receptors in the heart. You've got the beta kind, and it increases heart rate. Now, does that make sense in terms of the fight and flight versus rest and repose? Does that make sense? Because the sympathetic should do what? Should increase your heart rate, right? Should increase your blood pressure. And that's because the heart has beta-1 receptors. All right, let's look at the lungs right here. Bronchioles. All right, when should you increase your ventilatory function? When you're sleeping or when you're presented with a, maybe a harmful kind of stimulus? Yeah, a harmful stimulus, right? All right, so in order to increase air into your lungs, should these bronchioles constrict or should they dilate? All right, and maybe you haven't thought of that yet. We're going to talk about that and when we get to the cardiovascular chapter. But when a tube dilates, that increases flow. When a tube constricts, that impedes flow. So think of that as a door. If the door is partially closed, you have a hard time going through the door. But if the door is wide open, right, a lot of people can get through that doorway at the same time. So in the lungs, right, these airways dilate because they have beta-2 receptors. And this is due to what? Adrenergic stimulation, which is sympathetic nervous system. Right, so beta-2 receptors inhibit smooth muscles of bronchioles. The beta-1s, what, are excitatory. The beta-2s are inhibitory for smooth muscle. All right, so how are you going to remember these beta receptors? Which one has beta-1, which one have beta-2s? The heart has beta-1 because how many hearts you have? You've got one. The lungs have the beta-2 receptors because how many lungs do you have? You've got, you have two, right? The two major lobes. Okay, just remember, sympathetic is excitatory to the heart, inhibitory on the smooth muscle, which increases lung function. All right, so what's another good way to remember it? Here's another exam diagram. And if I look at this diagram right here, am I thinking somatic motor pathway or autonomic motor pathway? if you look at this right here? What's kind of tweaking your imagination to think one way or the other for this? Because how many neurons does it take to get from the spinal cord to skeletal muscle? Okay, central nervous system to skeletal muscle under voluntary control. How many neurons does that take?
One.
But how many neurons do you see here back to back in every particular case? You see two, so you got to know that's what? Autonomic outflow, right? That's some kind of autonomic outflow. And in particular, let's break it down into parasympathetic versus sympathetic. All right. So in an autonomic outflow pathway, we've got the preganglionic fiber and the postganglionic fiber. And that's true what? In every case that we see right here, because we don't have the adrenal medulla on this particular slide. So here is, right here, this would be, for instance, the ganglia. These are the ganglion cells right here. And what's the neurotransmitter that's used for both the sympathetic and parasympathetic? Yeah, so all of these fibers right here, all of these preganglionic neurons are which kind? They are cholinergic, right? So these are all cholinergic fibers because they're releasing acetylcholine. And of course, these are all what? Nice chemical synapses. These receptors on each of these postganglionic fibers are nicotinic receptors. What the heck does that mean if it's a nicotinic receptor? How is that working to change something about these postganglionic cells? They bind two acetylcholine molecules, and what does that change? Right, that opens up a sodium channel, which then depolarizes, right, produces an EPSP in all of these postganglionic cells. And those EPSPs run down to this axon hillock, and if they reach threshold, what happens in this axon? Action potential, which then moves down to the axon terminus. Okay. All right, if you have an action potential reaching this axon terminus for these postganglionic neurons, right, we can have different effects depending on whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic nervous system. So in the parasympathetic nervous system, what is this postganglionic fiber? How would you talk about that? It is cholinergic as well because it releases acetylcholine. But what about these three postganglionic cells for the sympathetic nervous system? These are adrenergic because they're releasing norepinephrine. All right. So, acetylcholine in the postganglionic neuron doesn't stimulate a nicotinic receptor. It's going to stimulate a muscarinic receptor. We're going to talk about some of those in just a little bit. All right. And that's going to produce parasympathetic nerve effects when acetylcholine binds to a muscarinic receptor. But what do you know about a muscarinic receptor? What is it, what is its type? Is it just a simple ion channel like a nicotinic? No, it's a G-protein coupled receptor, right? Okay, so that's why we're so interested in G-protein coupled receptors. All right, and then all of these adrenergic fibers over here also work on these different effector organs through what kind of receptor? Is it a simple ion channel, which we call an ionotropic, or is it going to change, is it going to start a second messenger, stimulate a second messenger system? It's going to work through a second messenger through a G protein coupled receptor. Okay, so we got the alpha and we got a couple betas right here. And can you remember the alpha type adrenergic receptors? What's the second messenger that develops inside the cell due to the alpha? The second messenger is calcium, okay, but the beta receptors work through cyclic AMP, okay. All right, so what do we got right here? Stimulates alpha-1 adrenergic receptors. These are usually always excitatory, which cause smooth muscle to contract, especially, and a good place to think of that is in blood vessels. And it's going to cause vasoconstriction of blood vessels, and especially in the skin and viscera. And we're going to see that that increases blood pressure or maintains blood pressure. All right, you got to talk about why that happens when we get into the cardiovascular system. Okay, but now let's look at the other postganglionic fibers, the beta-1. Where do you have beta-1 receptors? In the heart. And when sympathetic tone increases to the heart, what should happen to the heart when you're in a stressful circumstance? Should it slow down? No, it should speed up, and the force of contraction should increase, right? So beta 1 adrenergic receptors in the heart increase heart rate and force of contraction. Force of contraction, sometimes we just call contractility, right? And if it increases heart rate, right, is that going to have a negative or positive effect on the heart? Positive, it's going to be stimulatory, right? And we mentioned this way back when, the first week of school, right? We got two different effects right here, heart rate versus force of contraction. When we talk about heart rate, we call that chronotropy. Right, chrono like your watch, has to do with time. So norepinephrine working through beta 1 receptors are positive chronotropic agents. They increase heart rate, but that's not the only other thing they do. Right, maybe you're driving down the 405 and then it looks for sure you're going to get run over by 5 semi-tractor trailers going down the road, a huge accident, and no way to avoid that accident. You're sure you're going to die. Your heart rate goes up, but what else happens to you? Has anybody ever experienced that? Your heart rate goes up, but what else happens? Well, it feels like your heart is going to come bouncing right out of your mouth, out of your chest, right? It's the force of contraction increases as well, not just the rate. So two things happen. The rate, it's a positive chronotropic effect, but it's also a positive inotropic effect. The force of contraction increases due to this beta 1 stimulation. Both of these right here. Inotropic versus chronotropic. Inotropic. Look at your slides from lab from the first week. All right, these are effects. Sometimes we might call it inotropy. Inotropy refers to, I have to write like this, inotropy, force of contraction. And chronotropy is what? Rate. Okay, so what kind of receptor has a positive chronotropic effect and a positive inotropic effect on the heart? That would be a really good question. Would be an adrenergic. So now you're thinking all alpha, beta, but you should think of beta. But now you know there's beta 1, beta 2. It should be beta 1. Has a positive inotropic and chronotropic effect on the heart. All right, so when you're faced with a stressful circumstance, not only should your heart rate go up, but what about pulmonary function, your lung function? That should increase as well, right? And we need to inhibit some smooth muscle that control the diameter of bronchioles. We need to inhibit smooth muscles so that they dilate so air can move more easily through bronchioles. What kinds of receptors are those? Would it be a parasympathetic or sympathetic? It's a sympathetic, which then relies on an adrenergic receptor of some kind. And in particular, what kind you know is inhibitory on smooth muscle? It's not the alpha one that's stimulatory. It's the beta 2 in particular, right? So the beta 2 adrenergic receptor inhibits smooth muscles of bronchioles, which causes dilation, which increases ventilation. Should I say that again? Yeah, okay, so let's see if I can remember what I said. In the lungs, if you want to increase ventilatory function, you need to dilate bronchioles. You dilate bronchioles by inhibiting smooth muscles. So smooth muscles and bronchioles have beta 2 receptors. When they bind norepinephrine, that inhibits the smooth muscle, they dilate, and so it's easier to ventilate as a result. That's really close to what I said. Not exactly. A little bit different way. All right, so here is a particularly good exam figure, right, to help you just really ingrain that in your memory. And guess what? If any of you are lucky enough to get into some kind of clinical practice, you'll be using these different receptors, you know, like 20 times a day to keep people alive, right? So it's really important that you know different kinds of adrenergic receptors and where they're located in the body. And we're just kind of starting out in this class with how they're working. All right, so we're done talking about, thank you so much. So we're done talking about adrenergic receptors. So let's talk about cholinergic. What division of the autonomic nervous system has cholinergic receptors? In particular, the muscarinic receptors. That would be the parasympathetic nervous system. All right. But don't forget, acetylcholine is used where? All somatic motor synapses, like what? The neuromuscular junction for skeletal muscle. That's a nicotinic, that's an acetylcholine. It's a cholinergic receptor. And in particular, it is a nicotinic receptor. All preganglionic autonomic nerves are cholinergic. Right, and parasympathetic postganglionic fibers are cholinergic. Can you picture where that is? Where do you have the parasympathetic postganglionics? Yeah, they're cranial sacral. They're involved with that cranial sacral outflow. All right, so the two kinds of cholinergic, the two major subtypes, are nicotinic, which cause depolarization. They're blocked by a compound called curare. Right, so sometimes if an exogenous compound, a compound from outside your body, inhibits a particular receptor, we say it's an antagonist to that particular receptor. And if it stimulates that receptor, we say it is an agonist, right? Okay, so curare is an antagonist to nicotinic receptors, but not muscarinic receptors. There's a different kind of compound that can bind to muscarinic receptors, and that's called muscarin, and muscarin is a compound that's produced by certain kinds of mushrooms. And you probably all know that certain mushrooms, if you eat them, are deadly because they block the parasympathetic division of your autonomic nervous system, right? And it's really difficult to treat. And muscarinic receptors can be blocked by atropine. All right, so here are the two kinds of receptors that are cholinergic. You got the typical nicotinic kind, which is just a ion channel for sodium, primarily causing depolarization, which is excitation. So that's a nice simple excitatory event producing what? An EPSP. All right, but for muscarinic receptors, it can work either in two different ways. It can produce EPSPs or IPSPs, depending on how the system is built up in the plasma membrane. All right, so here is the first messenger, acetylcholine, binding to a receptor. But what kind of receptor is this? It's coupled to a G protein, right? It has to be activated by guanosine triphosphate. And when it is, you got these three different subunits. So that when acetylcholine binds to the receptor, these subunits can dissociate, break away from the receptor, and move along the surface of the membrane and bump into a different kind of membrane protein. And if this particular membrane protein is a potassium channel that opens up, what are the effects that are produced? Potassium is going to leave the cell, and when potassium leaves the cell, that's classically described as hyperpolarization. And does hyperpolarization move the membrane potential closer to threshold or farther away? Farther away from threshold, so is that an inhibition or an excitation? That's an inhibition. Okay. So that's one kind of muscarinic receptor. It can produce inhibition. And in particular, this is what we find in the heart that's going to produce a slower heart rate because these potassium channels open up. In other circumstances, you have a G-protein coupled receptor. When that G-protein dissociates and moves around, it might bump into a sodium or a calcium channel. And when it opens up, of course, sodium is going to enter the cell. That's classically described as depolarization. But what about calcium? Where's calcium high in a resting cell? On the outside of the cell, calcium can rush in. What does that produce? Depolarization, right, just like sodium, and that is going to produce EPSPs. All right, this other circumstance right here, we might have a potassium channel in the cell that under resting conditions is open, right? And if under resting conditions is open, what's the effect on the membrane potential if the potassium channel is open? It's going to cause hyperpolarization or repolarization is going to keep the membrane potential far away from threshold. But if this G-protein-coupled receptor becomes activated and it closes this potassium channel, what's going to happen to resting membrane potential? It's going to drift up toward the threshold. What do we call that when membrane potential drifts up to threshold? That's depolarization, right? So depolarization can be due to opening sodium or calcium channels, which depolarize the membrane, or closing potassium channels, which will also depolarize the membrane. And so these are going to produce EPSPs or excitation. All right, so you see nicotinic receptors over here causing depolarization. Muscarinic through G-protein coupled receptors can be inhibitory or excitatory depending on what kind of membrane channels are opened or closed. All right, so here is a table of some different kinds of cholinergic receptors, right? And so what are the two main kinds? Well, we got nicotinic and muscarinic. And look, we got a couple subclasses of muscarinic receptors. All right, we don't have different classes of nicotinic receptors. In every case, it's going to open up a sodium channel, which is going to be excitatory. And we see that in the neuromuscular junction and autonomic ganglia. Is that ringing a bell? Yeah, we looked at that. Okay, the muscarinic type receptors. Let's look at the heart. They're M2, right? These muscarinic receptors cause hyperpolarization because they open up. What causes hyperpolarization? That's going to be hyperpolarization drifting away from threshold. Yeah, I know. I got to be awake when I give this lecture too. All right, due to a potassium channel, right? That opens up. Right, so acetylcholine activates that G-protein coupled receptor, opening up potassium channels. That inhibits the heart. That slows the heart rate down. Right, the M3 and M5, these are what we find in smooth muscle and glands. These cause depolarization. They're excitatory. They cause contraction of smooth muscle and secretion from glands. Right, because acetylcholine, when it activates the G-protein coupled receptor, they open up calcium channels. Right, so M3 and M5 open up calcium channels, so calcium can rush inside the cell. That causes depolarization and EPSPs in smooth muscle. That's the last one. We did get through this lecture. All right, so over the weekend, you got to become really familiar with this chapter, and you got to write down your questions. Right, and so when you come to lecture on Tuesday, you got to ask me some really good questions. And you might have to dig out your anatomy books to look at that preganglionic, postganglionic, right? Sympathetic outflow versus parasympathetic outflow. All right, so that's it for today. Oh, the lecture? Usually by Saturday. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.